From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, portraying the president and fictionalizing the first lady, we talk with Josh Brolin, who stars in Oliver Stone's new film W, about the life of George W. Bush before and after he became president. Brolin starred in the Oscar-winning film No Country for Old Men and co-starred in American Gangster. Then we'll talk with Curtis Sittenfeld about her best-selling novel, American Wife. In this book, loosely based on the life of Laura Bush, Sittenfeld imagines the inner life of a woman who never expected her husband, a reformed alcoholic, to become president. Sittenfeld based the novel on details from Laura Bush's life, including her car accident that killed a high school classmate. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, Josh Brolin, plays George W. Bush in Oliver Stone's new movie, W. Brolin portrays Bush as a young man, drinking and carousing, before finding Jesus and launching his political career. And he's also President Bush, surrounded by familiar White House figures including Dick Cheney, played by Richard Dreyfuss, Donald Rumsfeld, played by Scott Glenn, and Karl Rove, played by Toby Jones. Josh Brolin followed his father, James Brolin, into acting. He had a respectable career in film and theater for more than 20 years, but wasn't a marquee name. That began to change last year, with attention-getting performances in American Gangster, In the Valley of Ella, and No Country for Old Men. Before we hear Brolin's interview with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, let's hear a clip from W. Bush is preparing to take on the incumbent governor of Texas, Ann Richards. He's sitting on a park bench being coached by Karl Rove.
What do you say that George W. Bush is a rich, spoiled jerk? His wealth was produced by stock swaps and bailouts arranged by his daddy.
Ann Richards can badmouth me all she wants. I've created successful small businesses. I run a Major League Baseball team. I'm in touch with real people in Texas. Work with them every day at the ballpark. Talk with the fans, hot dog vendors. Get to know what they think. Because truly, deep down inside, you know I'm a guy like you. A guy you can trust.
Fabulous. Fabulous, Dope. What it all comes down to is who Joe Voter wants to sit down and have a beer with. And guess who that is?
Just remember, make mine non-alcoholic.
So, anything about the issues, you come to me first, I'll tell you what to say.
Oh, you're not going to tell me what to say, Carl. I'm going to tell you what I want, because you're the word man. This campaign starts and ends with me and what I think.
You got it, W. I'm just a little fairy putting down a little magic dust for you.
Carl, this time I'm going to out Texas, Texas.
Well, Josh Brolin, welcome to Fresh Air. When you thought about taking this role on of George W. Bush, I wonder, did it seem risky? What did you consider in deciding whether to say yes?
When somebody like Oliver Stone, with the resume that he has, came to me and said, "I see George W. in you," it was disconcerting, to say the least. You know, I didn't quite understand why and what, and even when he told me, you guys grew up on a ranch together, you have followed in the same footsteps as your fathers, very strong mothers, you know, whatever cosmetics he had read in the press or... And I still didn't get it. And, you know, without reading the script, I was very reactionary. I imagined it to be something, you know, in the present and having to do with the war. And it wasn't until I read it that I finally understood, you know, it was one of the great acting challenges for me, at least up until this point, to follow this guy's life from 21 years old to 58 years old. So it seemed like a great challenge, and, you know, it put me into a fear that I enjoy, which is, can I live up to this character, as opposed to my first reaction, which was looking down on it, saying, why would I want to do that?
So it was a challenge. How did you prepare?
Insanely. I mean, I threw my family for sure, and I talked to myself a lot. I watched a lot of videos. I practiced a lot of different types of body language because we covered a lot of different times in his life, and I thought they would be different. How he walked, how he sounded at 21, how he sounded at 31, how he sounded at 47 when he became, when he started to run for Congress and the gubernatorial thing. And so there were a lot of different milestones I wanted to really get specific on. And I watched a lot of video, I read a lot of books, I learned a lot about the other party, and I learned a lot about the evangelical movement, I learned a lot about just the right. And there's some things that, to my surprise, I respected and glad I'm more educated on now, because now I can make a more educated decision on who I want to be in office.
Well, I knew that you would have, of course, spent an awful lot of time watching video of him and reading about him. And I'm wondering, what did you notice when you really looked at George W. Bush that hadn't occurred to you before?
I don't know. You know, I had heard things because my reaction was just political with him, you know. And again, I believe it was a cosmetic reaction. I had written him off by the time Oliver had come to me, which I've since then... learned and feel very that is incredibly irresponsible to do that.
He's we should be explicit and tell us what your view of him was before.
I don't know if I want to get into that because then it's very political, which people feel that that's what this movie is when it really is a biopic. You know, the politics is absolutely a part of it because it's a huge part of his life. But we follow him through, you know, how does a guy who's floundering through most of his life and obviously and admittedly so a big drinker, you know, stop that, turn his life around, deepen his relationship with Jesus and become president of the United States twice? You know, I don't think I really need to get specific on how I feel about George W. Bush because I think the majority of the country, going from the highest approval rating of any president to the lowest. And you look at our economy now, and I don't think it's just him. I think it's the entire administration. So, you know, I had very strong feelings about it. And then you start to do your research, and then there's things that I felt were very positive and very interesting about his life.
Yeah, like what?
The milestones. Yeah. You know, I mean, the most obvious are how he dealt with his drinking at 40 years old. It's my life is not going the way I want it to. You know, you drink in order to loosen up, to feel more humorous and all that, and then it backfires, and you end up embarrassing yourself and embarrassing your wife and your kids and your friends. And I think it takes a lot of will to what I think he believed is exercising those demons and, again, using Christ as a new foundation in order to hold strong to that not drinking anymore. And the way I see it is you don't exercise those demons ever. They'll just manifest in a different way if you don't keep tabs on them. And he had a great opportunity through the war to manifest those. Or they had a great opportunity, despite him.
So what demons do you see emerging as he pursues the war?
I feel that, you know, whatever demons that you're dealing with, in his case, the drinking, or in his case, his relationship with his father, or wanting to live up to something, or constantly feeling like you're failing with the oil business, with wanting to be baseball commissioner, and things not panning out the way you want them to, and then suddenly you're president of the United States after only being governor, losing a congressional race, becoming governor, and then bang, you're in the presidency, and there's nothing to do. I mean, there wasn't a lot going on. Clinton had set it up, regardless of, you know, his trials and tribulations. He had set up a pretty decent economy and rescued us for the most part. And then suddenly 9/11 happens. It gives you direction. It allowed direction for him. A very directionless guy his entire life, with the exception of stopping drinking and the relationship with Christ and the process of that. And I think it was a great ability for him. It gave him great ability to be able to focus and to use his steel will and gift of conviction and give him purpose.
Talk a little bit about getting Bush down physically. What did you have to work on?
There was everything. You know, I watched him, I watched videos and watched the difference between when he was tired and not tired, when he was in public, when he was in private, how he was with, you know, Tony Blair as opposed to some prime minister or premier over in the...
And what differences did you see?
How he held himself, how he compensated, how erect he was, how, you know, his hands, I don't know why, he has this apish thing that he does where the back of his hands are always facing forward, which I thought was really interesting. He's always moving, this kind of ADD thing, what we do in the movie, and you've seen the movie, was we chose to eat a lot, to be busy during scenes, which, you know, if you look at something like No Country for Old Men, it's the opposite.
Right.
You know, it's all about the quiet. It's all about how do you convey ideas through subtleties, whereas Bush, I think, is the opposite. You know, there's a lot of talking going on. There's a lot of movement going on. So there were a lot of different things that I did. I drove my wife crazy because we went on vacation, and I was just studying the whole time, and I had to memorize a lot of different names, and I was using people on the plane as mnemonics, and I was talking to myself a lot on the plane, and my wife just kept saying, hey, do you realize that people can see you? Do you realize that you're not invisible? You know, or we'd be walking on the beach, and without me consciously thinking about it, because, you know, it was out of fear. It was a very subconscious, unconscious, somewhat conscious fear that was happening. Can I live up to this role? Can I do this role? So I'm sure even in my sleep, I was always trying to question myself, you know, what am I missing? What am I missing? What am I not getting?
Yeah, well, you know, the film opens with a scene of you in the Oval Office with the cast of characters, you know, Cheney and Rumsfeld and Powell. And it's the scene where you're coming up with the phrase axis of evil for the State of the Union address. And I have to say that when you see you opening up in that scene, you get a sense mm-hmm. that you really nailed this. I mean, it really looks like George W. Bush conducting a meeting and making a decision. But, you know, there's a difference between doing an impression of somebody and then inhabiting the character. And I wonder if that was a struggle for you to get his mannerisms and voice so familiar that then you could kind of forget about it and then interpret him as a character.
No, I know what you're saying. And, yeah, I mean, you never know until it's out there. I mean, now it's going to be out there, or the beginnings of it being out there have happened. The press have seen it, and now the public is going to see it in a couple of weeks. And, you know, it's always a struggle because, especially with this character, you're not just doing one voice. You're not just doing the present or 2002 or to 2004, you know, this kind of tight diaphragm, breathy, you know, thing that he has that we all know so well. You know, there's a lot of different voices in this movie. There's, you know, how Western is he when he's 21 years old and he's in his second year of Yale or his first year at Yale? You know, how much was he affected and influenced by, you know, Eastern dialects? Or did he fight it completely and actually the Western dialect came out even more because he wanted to overcompensate because he wasn't having a good time during his school years? Or, you know what I mean? So you're constantly questioning these possibilities and the levels. So I think, you know, part of what you're asking is, you know, there was a moment where when I finally came down to the voice that we know so well, and it was the scene where HUD walks in when W's governor and he's become governor, and he says, you know, hello, you know, HUD, come on in, why don't you take a seat? And that's when we did the full-blown voice for the first time. And when we went through it, after they said cut, you know, all of us, me and Oliver and the whole crew, started cracking up because it was nerve-wracking. You know, obviously I want to do a good job and I want it to be accurate and I don't want to do necessarily some caricature of it, but you want it to feel right. And that partially comes with body language, that partially comes with not overdoing it, it partially comes with subtleties and breath and voice. And so, you know, as you can hear in my voice right now, this is what I went through every minute of every day, not knowing.
So you
I
said
can't
HUD
answer your
came
question.
In?
Don't ask me any more questions.
All right. You said HUD came in the room. You're referring to who?
Stacy Keach.
Oh, okay. And he Stacy was Keach. Playing the minister, right? Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay. We're speaking with Josh Brolin. He plays George W. Bush in the new movie, W. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is actor Josh Brolin. He plays George W. Bush in the new Oliver Stone film, W. He kicked alcohol, I guess, at about 40, which is your age, right?
Exactly, at 40, which is exactly my age.
And I read that you swore off alcohol during the shooting. Is that right?
Yeah, but I do that anyway for the most part. You know, I mean, part of it had to do with the weight. You start drinking alcohol. I lost a lot of weight in the beginning, and if you drink, there's so many calories in alcohol, and it's hard to keep the weight off. So that was part of it. And the other part of it was I needed truly to be massively focused. That I was in on every page, I think, with the exception of 5 pages in a 120-some-odd page script. And so I really needed to keep the focus, you know. And then that was part of it. I mean, I had this idea that I didn't follow through with, was that I'll do the opposite. I won't drink while he's drinking in the movie, and then I will start drinking because, to me, once he becomes president, or once he stops drinking at 40, because there's something that happened at 40. Even though he stopped drinking, there's more of a confusion, at least I see in his eyes. later in life. So I thought maybe that would help. Maybe if I'm drunk a lot, that'll help. But I
to drink when he's president, not when.
Yeah, exactly. Right. To do the opposite, you know. And I thought maybe it'd have an interesting effect, but I chose not to drink at all, and because I needed to be sharp, and I'm glad I didn't.
Just a couple more things about some of the demands of playing this role. You eat a lot in this movie. I mean, you have conversations where you're eating, and I noticed that it's not these things where people sort of pretend to eat or have a plate in front of them. You're really downing the sandwich. And I wondered, did you get stuffed in multiple retakes?
Well, you know, I mean, it lent to, I told you, Oliver and I had made the decision that we want him to keep moving, you know, and this kind of ADD quality. And finally, you know, I had lost, again, just to look younger, not because it sounds cool, because it's no fun, but, you know, you lose weight, and I cut my hair, and to be able to look 21, because I was very afraid that I wouldn't, being 40 years old. And right after that first week of the youngest scenes, from 21 to 25, I had then 8-9 weeks to gain as much weight as I could, as fast as I could, and my body was so used to losing weight that it was very, very difficult. We were eating banana and avocado shakes, about 12 a day. And then I was going to McDonald's right before I went to sleep. So my sleep pattern changed. I felt awful. And wait, what was your question again? No, I was getting to it. What was the point?
How could you stand?
Well, the eating, right?
Eating
so much
on the set. Yeah.
So that the scene with Richard Dreyfuss, I ended up eating 15 sandwiches. Which was horrible. I mean, it was horrible. But it was good because I was forced to do it in the scene, which, you know, lent to me gaining another, I'm sure, 3 or 4 pounds for that day.
You immersed yourself in this character. You said, you know, there were times when you would be walking on the beach or just sitting on an airplane and you'd lapse into it. Have you gotten that out of your system?
I don't know. You know, it's been 8 weeks. I think it sounds, for an actor to say, no, I think it's still in there. You know, we all want to bring Brando, right?
Right.
But it's. I think that, you know, it's only been 8 weeks. I don't like telling jokes right now because it comes out like, okay, so a guy walks into a bar, you know, and you go, oh, man, the kids are like, would you stop? The movie's finished. It's over, you know, but... It wasn't the fact that I was walking. That was more out of, you know, finding it. It was when I finally started working on the movie that I didn't go out. I was very afraid to go out. So we would work and we would come home and we would study. I think I went out to dinner twice. That was it. I just ate at home for the 2 months that we were in Shreveport. So I'm sure there's still residual there.
Well, I have to
I don't
tell
know
you.
Where, which kind of scares me.
I have to tell
I'm
you.
I'm sure it's still there.
When I hear you start that joke, I want to hear the rest of it. That's just so much fun to hear you do that.
It's fun. You know, we're going to do Saturday Night Live soon, and we're in the process of figuring out the skits and all that, and it'll be fun to be able to do it, you know, with this new resurgence of Palin, and, you know, everybody's watching Saturday Night Live now because of Tina Fey. I can't wait, and I hope to be able to do something with her, you know, a Palin W something. I don't know what it will be.
Now, I read that you are, of course, the son of the actor James Brolin, and I read that you grew up on a ranch, and I was trying to picture whether your childhood was more Hollywood or more ranch life. Which was it? Or both?
Well, was definitely more ranch life. My parents, I would assume, consciously kept me away from Hollywood. My mother was very distrustful of Hollywood and those types. who I guess is me now, I don't know. I was raised in Paso Robles, Templeton, California, and we had 65 horses, you know, give or take a few at different times. And my father went back and forth to Los Angeles, and my mother's from Texas, and she loved the country, and she didn't want to spend any time in the city. So I'm very grateful for that. I did the same thing for my kids. My kids grew up about 3 miles from where I grew up. And it was nice to be able to keep them out of Los Angeles.
Well, so you grew up on a ranch, but you found your way into acting, you know, as a young adult. Did you always think you'd want to follow your dad's footsteps?
No, not at all. I was very against it. When my friends found out that that's what I finally wanted to do or was willing to experiment with, they were all very surprised. Now, law was something that I loved. I loved debate. I loved law, and through high school, taking youth and society and law 1 through law 6 or whatever it was, from freshman to a senior. Acting was, but that's, you know, there's a connection there. I'm seeing now, obviously, between law and being a lawyer and being an actor. No, I wasn't interested at all. And then around 11th grade, I had the opportunity to take an acting class or in school. It was an improv class, an improvisational class. And that's, you know, when I finally said, yeah, I'll do it and see what it's like. And I'm just out of curiosity. And I wasn't interested because I saw my father, you know, he'd have money one year and he wouldn't have any the next year, and he would have some the next year. So the fluctuation, no security. And but when I did it, the improvisational, I don't know, experimenting with voice and character and all that was really a turn on for me. It was like a drug. You could really lose yourself and be writing your own dialogue, and the whole delving into storytelling was really profound and interesting.
Josh Brolin and Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies will continue their conversation in the second half of the show. Brolin portrays George W. Bush in the new movie W. Dave Davies is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. From MasterCard, World MasterCard is designed to give you access to a world of possibilities. Learn more at priceless.com/world. And from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review. Online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, imagining the inner life of a first lady whose husband has become very unpopular. We talked to Curtis Sittenfeld about her best-selling novel, American Wife, inspired by the life of Laura Bush. And we continue our conversation with Josh Brolin, who plays President Bush in the new film W. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Josh Brolin, who stars as George W. Bush in Oliver Stone's new movie, W. Brolin spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
You've had a string of very well-received performances in the last few years. I mean, you did American Gangster with Ridley Scott, where you played the corrupt cop, and then you were another cop in The Valley of Elah with Paul Haggis. And then there is, of course, No Country for Old Men. And I thought we should talk about that a little bit, the Coen Brothers film. And I thought we'd begin by listening to a little bit of you from that film. This is Your character, Llewellyn Moss, who has found $2 million in cash after a drug shootout and is trying to get away with it, but a very, very scary killer, Anton Chigurh, who's played by Javier Bardem, is after you. You've sent your wife off to live to her mom's place in Odessa, and in this conversation, Bardem has caught up with you on the telephone. Let's listen.
Yeah, I know where you're going.
All right.
You know she won't be there.
It doesn't make any difference where she is.
So what are you going up there for?
You know how this is going to turn out, don't you?
Nope.
I think you do. So this is what I'll offer. You bring me the money and I'll let her go. Otherwise, she's accountable. The same as you. That's the best deal you're gonna get. I won't tell you you can save yourself, because you can't.
Yeah, I'm gonna bring you something, all right. Decided to make you a special project of mine. You ain't gonna have to come look for me at all.
And that's Josh Brolin with Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men. You know, what's interesting about you and this character, I mean, you play this... he's a welder who lives out in rural West Texas who happens upon this chance for a score. I mean, you're on the screen a lot in this movie, often without lines. There's just a lot of shots of you observing and figuring out stuff. How is acting different when you're really not doing it verbally so much?
For me, it was a great challenge just because, you know, dialogue is, especially coming from the theater, a lot of the work that I've done is dialogue motivated. So this was a nice challenge to be able to figure out how to convey ideas through body language and through grunts and groans. I mean, I remember there was a moment where I find the money. Llewellyn finds the money and he opens up the satchel and looks down. Then he looks at the dead guy and he looks up. And I actually had a full blown conversation with the Coens about adding "mm-hmm," because there's this dialogue and to me in his head about should I take it? You know, should I go with this? Should I not go with this? There was this constant dialogue in his head that he would answer monosyllabically. And so we had, you know, the fact that we had a conversation about going "mm-hmm" or "mm" or "mm," you know, seemed a little ridiculous to me. But that was the nature of the movie, and I liked it. It was a nice experiment and seemed to work, which I was very happy about.
Was it hard to get that part?
To get the job, to get cast. Or understand the part?
No, getting cast. Yeah, by the Coen brothers.
Yeah, it was very difficult. I had auditioned for it, and I was doing Grindhouse with Robert Rodriguez, and Quentin was on the set, Quentin Tarantino, and we ended up doing an audition tape. I ended up doing an audition tape with them that Quentin directed and Robert shot. We sent it to the Coens, and the Coens' response was, who lit it? It's the most beautiful audition tape we've ever seen, but we're not interested in the guy acting in it. They didn't know my work, and I went, hmm. And I had read the book, and I thought it was an amazing character, and I just told my agent, I said, just keep on them, you know? If I can just get in a room, that's all I want to do. If it doesn't work out, that's fine. I just want to be able to get in a room. And during their last audition, they finally called my agent, and they said, listen, we'll give him a shot. You know, he can come in if he can make it at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, and it was 11 o'clock the night before. So they sent me 6 scenes, and I studied, and I got down there, 2-hour drive. I got down there at 9 o'clock that morning and that next morning, and I got the part the next day.
Well, you know, I was born in Lubbock and have a lot of family in West Texas, and one of the things about that movie, it just seems to get those folks and the accents so dead on. And I'm wondering if your experience with a mother from Texas and growing up on a ranch, do you think gave you an edge or informed it in some way?
No, because as you know, my mother, you know, from Southwest Texas, she was from Corpus Christi.
Uh-huh.
So it's very different, very, very, very different mentalities. Sure. Texas is a big state, you know, and as you know, West Texas is very, very different than East Texas. So, you know, I played that up with the Coens. Hey, you know, by the way, you know, see, everything I do is Bush. You see what I started to do? I started to tell a joke and it came out as Bush.
Go ahead, do it, man. Do it.
No, it's awful. I'm so sick of it. I'm starting telling you stories about Llewellyn, and it comes out sounding like W. It's the weirdest thing. I remember in Lubbock, you know, it's just wrong. Anyway, I played it up for the Coens that my mom was from Texas and I grew up on a ranch and therefore I'm perfect for this part. You know, but you do that with Ridley. I'm sure I said, you know, I was in the mafia and I grew up in, you know, South Bronx and all that.
So you get the job and then you work it. Right, okay.
And then you work it, you know, and then you become it as best you can.
You know, I read that you have had a pretty serious side career as a day trader in stocks. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a point in my career that I didn't, I mean, I knew the stock market and I knew how to play a little bit. I didn't know a lot. I was more interested in it. I was always a good math student when I was a kid in school. And there came a point in my career where I didn't like really the jobs that I had to do in order to pay for my kids' school or, you know, whatever, put food on the table. And we sold our ranch about 4 years ago, and it gave me an opportunity to really focus on the work that I wanted to do and not work when I didn't have to and just do theater and you know, and keep playing with the craft in any way that I could. But the movies, you know, they're indelible. It was important to me to be able to look back on my resume and like what I saw and remember the experiences with fondness. You know, and so during that time, I started. I met a guy, Brett Markinson, and he really taught me a lot about trading. And we started a company together, Market Probability, and we've done very well. I mean, just in the last, and obviously, we're not trading right now because of the uncertainty. But before this whole debacle started to happen in the last, I mean, it's happened in the last year, but really in the last 2 or 3 months, you know, we were 73% for the year, so we were doing very, very well.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to think of two pursuits more disparate than acting, where you're, you know, delving into the human soul, and then all the kind of technical analysis that comes with being an effective stock analyst or trader.
I see only the connections. I don't see the. Okay. I can see how you would see that it would be on opposite ends of the spectrum, but I see it like golf. You know, you have to technically figure out exactly the swing and how to hold your hands and, you know, visualize this and do all this. And there's so many things to learn technically with golf. But when it comes down to it, when you're finally going to take that swing, you have to completely erase it all from your mind and just let it happen. Otherwise, if you're thinking too much, you won't even be able to hit the ball.
When I look at some of the roles you've had, like an American Gangster, where you play the corrupt cop, and Valley of Ela, where you play a police, another cop, and then No Country for Old Men, where you play Llewellyn Moss, it seems to me that you bring a sort of classic sort of masculinity, kind of the, I don't know, a Robert Mitchum sort of feel to some of these roles. And I'm wondering, you just so easily play a tough guy. Do you think of yourself as a tough guy?
No, not at all. And I don't think anybody who knows me thinks of me as a tough guy. I think the public perception is that. Uh-huh. But these roles, I mean, look, I mean, you know, Bush, is Bush a tough guy? You know, he may come across as a tough guy. What I like about these roles is the fallibility of the role. You know, with Llewellyn Moss, he comes across as a tough guy, but he turns out to be extremely fallible, you know, and he's very sensitive, especially with his wife. You know, why is he doing what he's doing? Because he wants to give his wife a better life. You know, that's wonderful. It's sensitive. It's, you know, but it is manly, I think, in the end. I think with Detective Truppo, you know, I worked very closely with Ridley on the arc of that role, and we changed. We wrote the ending together because I wanted him. He was such an extreme ego and so overconfident and so, you know, bloated with his own, you know, success, that I wanted it to be as severe at the end of, you know, the movie where he takes his own life, which was not how it was written. We did that. And then, you know, so the machismo factor is wonderful. It just, Mitchum was always macho from beginning to end.
Right.
I like the fallibility of machoism. I like how fragile it all is. I like exploring that. So I like to be able to fluctuate within that idea of things and turn it on its head, hopefully.
Well, it'll be great to see where you go next. Josh Brolin, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Josh Brolin plays George W. Bush in Oliver Stone's new movie, W. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. Here's a scene from W in which George and Laura meet for the first time at a barbecue. Laura is played by Elizabeth Banks.
Come here. I'd like you to meet George Bush, Jr.
Laura Welch.
Call me anything but Junior.
I'll take that.
What do you do, Laura?
I read, I smoke.
Uh-huh.
I admire.
You admire what?
People who write, who read. I'm a librarian.
Uh-oh.
No,
actually, I'm reading something right now. Yeah, a very engaging book.
Oh, what is it?
Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative.
Uh-oh. Jan!
No, don't tell me.
Well, I worked on Gene McCarthy's campaign and voted for LBJ.
Oh, no. No. Well, looks like we're hitting it off like grease hits a skillet, huh?
Well, I don't think politics should define a human being. There's more to people than just how they vote.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. You're open-minded. Yeah, much more so than me, I'd have to say.
I read the paper that you're running for Congress.
Yes, ma'am, I am. And I don't believe in forcing myself on people, so that's why I'm just going to ask for your phone number, not your vote.
You're a devil. Devil in a white hat.
The life of Laura Bush is the inspiration for the new best-selling novel, American Wife. Coming up, we talk with the author, Curtis Sittenfeld. This is Fresh Air. Laura Bush has not discussed her private thoughts or her inner life with the press, but novelist Curtis Sittenfeld has tried to imagine what would go on in the mind of a first lady like Laura Bush. In Sittenfeld's new bestseller, American Wife, she's created a fictional first lady named Alice Blackwell, who watches with surprise as her husband rises through politics, becomes a very popular president, and eventually becomes very unpopular as a result of a war and his other policies. Although those who hate Blackwell's husband hate her by extension, she secretly disagrees with many of his policies, too. Many of the details in Alice Blackwell's life come from the biography of Laura Bush, but many don't. Curtis Sittenfeld is also the author of the best-selling novel Prep. Curtis, the novel is so much about the thoughts, the often hidden thoughts, in the mind of your main character. Why did you want to imagine through fiction what Laura Bush is really thinking?
Well, I really admire Laura Bush, which I think some people who know me think is strange because I'm a very liberal Democrat. But when I first read articles about her, you know, this would be early in 2001, she was very different from her sort of obvious or stereotypical public persona. And I think people see her as sort of stiff and proper and heavily made up, but she's actually supposed to be very down to earth, very unpretentious. You know, there's these stories about at the governor's mansion, there would be parties and she would leave the party and go play with the dogs in the yard. And, you know, she would fly southwest all over Texas visiting her friends. She would shop at Walmart. She would go to the post office herself to mail letters. So I felt like she was a very sort of sincere, down-to-earth person. And then also, all through her 20s, she was a Democrat who worked at low-income, ethnically diverse schools, which, you know, she intentionally sought out. And it was very intriguing to me how someone who was still a Democrat into her early 30s would feel marrying into this, you know, staunch Republican family.
The prologue to your novel begins with the question, "Have I made mistakes?" And the prologue ends with the line, "I lead a life in opposition to itself." Why does your character Alice think she's living a life in opposition to itself?
Well, one important distinction I have to make is that I don't consider Alice Blackwell in American Wife to be the same as Laura Bush. But the character that I've created, Alice Blackwell, does remain a Democrat, sort of a quiet, secret Democrat, even after she marries into a Republican family. And so for decades, she has different political leanings than her husband, and she doesn't anticipate that he'll ever be elected office, let alone that he'll become president. And she also has, you know, again, a kind of quiet sense of morality. And so she has to, she's not someone who can just make decisions or act falsely and disregard them. You know, she does take things seriously and she tries to live on her own terms, but that becomes increasingly difficult.
Yeah, you imagine that she married a man and ended up being married to a president, something she's completely unprepared for, and she feels very kind of guilty and responsible for decisions he's made that she doesn't agree with.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And at the same time, he's always still her husband and he's always still a man, but then, you know, it's almost like he's leading a double life as their marriage progresses. I mean, not a double life in the secretive sense, but just that a public life and a private life, and that she still loves him privately, but she feels increasingly uncomfortable with some of the political decisions he makes.
Some conservatives have described your book as a smear book because it's a book that imagines or appears to imagine what Laura Bush's inner life is like. In your novel, The First Lady, when she's a teenager, long before she's First Lady, has an abortion, something that needs to be kept secret. There are sexual scenes between the First Lady and her husband. And so for some people, that makes the whole book into a smear. Why would you argue that it's not? You know, that they're, what do you think they're seeing inaccurately about it?
Well, I'm fairly sure that, you know, 99%, if not 100% of the people who are saying the book is a smear haven't read it. So, you know, I can see that someone might have an idea of it or an impression of it, but the book, you know, could be different from what they think. You know, the point of a novel, or to me, the point of a novel, the gift of a novel, is to go really deeply inside people's lives and inside their personal experiences. And that includes things like sex. You know, there's a 30-year marriage. Of course they have sex. And there are all sorts of other things depicted, you know, like fights or, you know, feeling sick or, you know, their experiences with their daughter. And it's just part of their life together. And, you know, there's a lot of sex in a lot of books. It's not an unusual thing to have sex scenes in a novel.
If I were Laura Bush, here's something I think I'd be worried about your book. Because you give the character an abortion when she's a teenager, I think I would be worrying, will that plant the seed in readers' minds that maybe I had an abortion and I covered it up when I didn't? And although it's fiction and it's clearly labeled fiction and it's just so obviously fiction, it's also inspired by the story of Laura Bush, and suddenly there's this idea that's planted.
When
that line between reality and fiction is a little blurry.
I definitely don't think that Laura Bush had an abortion, and I'm not trying to make anyone else think that. I mean, again, this is a novel. I had to create a plot because that's what you do when you write fiction. I feel like if this book makes people curious about Laura Bush and want to know more about her, there are lots of biographies about her out there. There's the one that I relied on most that I think is really great is called The Perfect Wife, The Life and Choices of Laura Bush. And it's by someone who works at the Washington Post named Anne Gerhart. But I feel like if you read something and it makes you so curious about a topic that you then go read something else, that's exciting. And that's, I don't know. I mean, the information is very easy to find about Laura Bush's real life.
Do you see the Bushes differently after imagining Laura Bush's inner life for your novel?
Well, sometimes when I read about Laura Bush, when I read an article, I feel more of a sense of, I don't know, connection. I don't know if that sounds too creepy, but I feel more of a sense of connection than when I see her on television. She seems very distant on television. You know, she sort of holds herself just kind of apart, which in a way is one of the things that I admire about her. I admire the fact that she doesn't just give her soul away or even worse, pretend to give her soul away. So, I mean, I definitely see the Bushes as real people and not just as kind of these two-dimensional political figures that exist for me to mock or disagree with, even though I often do disagree with, you know, especially with President Bush. But I think, you know, they're real people with sort of likes and dislikes and fears and little daily habits. And you know, they have sort of these relationships with their children or their friends or family members that are probably a lot like the ones that I have with my friends and family members.
My guest is Curtis Sittenfeld. Her new novel, American Wife, is loosely based on the life of Laura Bush. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with Curtis Sittenfeld. Her new bestseller, American Wife, is loosely based on the life of Laura Bush. Your first novel, Prep, was based on your experiences in prep school. You were how old when it was published?
I was 29.
29. Oh, I was thinking you were really, really young. It's really not that young.
I was over the hill.
She goes, your character goes to prep school because the campus is beautiful and she imagines meeting an athletic, attractive boy who loves books as much as she does, who can take walks on overcast days with them both wearing warm wool sweaters. Was that an appealing image for you, too, before you went?
Sure. I would say, and this is sort of a pattern clearly with my books, but I don't feel like the book is based on my own experiences, although I did go to boarding school. You know, I certainly feel like I borrowed from the setting and the kind of, you know, dynamic and tone of boarding school, but I don't feel like it's an autobiographical novel. You know, which I think, you know, I can see these parallels emerging between the ways that I would say, you know, prep's not about me, and now I'll say American Wife is not about Laura Bush. And of course, I mean, they sort of are, but in a lot of ways, they sincerely aren't. But in terms of the idea of boarding school, I think that there are plenty of, you know, 13 or 14 year old girls and probably 13 or 14 year old boys who sort of think, oh, boarding school, so glamorous, so romantic.
You know, I've asked you some questions about false assumptions people might make about Laura Bush based on your fictitious portrayal of her in your novel. I'm wondering what false assumptions people have made about you based on your novel Prep. Because you went to prep school and the novel is about a girl who goes to prep school and who isn't from the wealthy backgrounds that most of the students in the school are.
Well, I think in my first two novels, both the characters are pretty neurotic, which I would say that I am. But they're also, I mean, they're sort of, I suppose you could say that sometimes their negative moods or thoughts outweigh their positive ones. And so I think actually a lot of people who meet me, you know, readers at events at bookstores or something might say, you seem so normal or you're so friendly or, you know, like I thought you'd be crippled by awkwardness. And I mean, I think that I'm a more average person than people might imagine, because people assume that I'm my characters, which, you know, I feel like I've created my characters.
Your name is Curtis, which is almost always a male name. My name is Terry, and I spell it T-E-R-R-Y. So just looking at my name, if you're just reading my name, you have no idea whether I'm male or female. And I've gotten many, many, many Mr. Terry Gross letters over the years. What's it been like for you to go through life with a name that appears to be the name that belongs to a guy?
Well, actually, the amazing thing, you know, sometimes I try, you know, not to look at stuff online, but occasionally there will be, you know, it will appear on the screen before me, and people will say things like, one of my favorite comments ever, it was about PrEP, and it said, this book is set at a boarding school, and it's by a person who clearly has never been to one, written from the perspective of a girl by someone who never was one. You know, like, so I was sort of saying, like, what gives you the authority to write from the perspective of a woman? Or conversely, I think there have been times in my life when people have assumed I'm a man and they've said, you know, the way that he gets into the heads of his female characters is so sensitive and extraordinary. And then, of course, they're actually way less impressed when they realize my gender.
Well, Curtis Sittenfeld, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Curtis Sittenfeld's new book is the bestseller American Wife. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Do Gentlemen Really Prefer Blondes? The Science Behind Sex, Love, and Attraction by Jenna Pincott. And from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, five generations of New England farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how the National Security Agency has turned up the volume on Americans. We talk with James Bamford about his new book, The Shadow Factory, the ultra-secret NSA from 9/11 to the eavesdropping on America. It's his third book about the NSA. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.